Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is Rahul Brown, and I'm your host this week for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Thank you and welcome. The purpose of these calls is really to share stories and to tell stories. Stories that help us plant the seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their action to live in a more service-oriented way. Behind each one of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to make this possible. Today, our special guest is none other than Cheryl Angel, who really embodies the theme of standing tall at Standing Rock. Thank you again for joining us for today's call. We'll start with just a minute of silence to anchor ourselves. Thank you, and welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Cheryl Angel. Here's how the call is going to work. In a few minutes, our moderator, Colleen Choi, will engage in a deep dialogue with Cheryl, and by the top of the hour, we're going to roll into Q&A and a circle of sharing, where we invite all of your reflections and questions. The queue is actually open right now, so at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us questions at ask@servicespace.org. As I mentioned, this week's theme is standing tall at Standing Rock. And, to me, what this means is really the capacity and ability to stand for the principles that Standing Rock was all about, meaning coming from a space of sort of protecting water and doing it from an authentic spirit of love in the face of something other than that. And we have the pleasure of having Colleen with us today as our moderator, who was also at Standing Rock. And I'm sure, Colleen, you saw lots of people attempting to embody this. Cheryl is a particularly brilliant example of holding true to those principles. Are there any thoughts that you would want to lead us into, Colleen, before we kick off the conversation with Cheryl?
Yeah, I was with Cheryl for 2 months while I was at Standing Rock, and I lived with her. So I was able to really observe Cheryl in everyday life, not even just for the big things, but for the small things, like how she would spend all day washing dishes or spend hours on end smudging people, to going to the front line to pray to police with water cannons shooting over her head, to leading 800 people to the front line and holding space for prayer. I mean, you know, it's something that she was unwavering, and she did day in and day out for months. And I'm so inspired by her, and I think being with her for that time really, changed me. So I feel so honored to be on this call with all of you and with Cheryl.
Well, wonderful. Yeah, I can see how that would really be a life-changing thing. Colleen, I'll just hand it over to you to kind of give a deeper intro. I mean, we already heard a little bit about Cheryl there, but if there's a deeper intro you'd like to make to sort of start there and then move into conversation.
Okay. When I first met Cheryl, I remember it was at an action. We were doing a walk to to Turtle Island. It was a youth-led action, and we were making a human medicine wheel. And I just saw this woman running back and forth, like serving the youth, making sure everyone was safe, I mean, among 600 people. And at one point, we met, and she just had so much warmth and kindness to her. And she just smiled and said, "Oh, do you want to live with me?" I was like, "Yeah." So that, I mean, that was the start of it. And Cheryl has stood up against two pipelines. So Standing Rock is the second one. And I believe, you know, her real life mission is to spread the message that water is life and protect water. And how she does that is in ceremony. And at camp, we start in ceremony and we end in ceremony. So both of us felt it was appropriate that this call is also a ceremony. And I'd love to invite Cheryl to start the ceremony for us.
Thank you for that introduction, both of you. I'm humbled. I feel like there's somebody else on the line here with me, that Cheryl, that has done all these great things. So I'm standing here with, you know, I have the chills just from hearing your good words, and I want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for sharing this space with me so I can share a message that's going to benefit not only the people, but it's going to begin a healing for the people and a change how we relate to the earth and how we treat the earth and how we can make a stand and how we recognize that it is a stand that needs to be made by anybody who's standing on the earth drinking water. So I always tell all the people I meet that Standing Rock was a ceremony. We have space, spiritual space, for ceremonies, for all the people that were in ceremony that came to that spot. So I would like to start with a song, because that's how we start ceremony. It's not a very long song, and I'll just sing one phrase instead of the normal. We usually do everything four times, but I'll only sing this phrase one time because of the time allotment. Wakantanta dokhaheya jewakiyelo hai.
Thank
you,
Cheryl.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Colleen.
I think, wow, after that beautiful opening, it brings to heart the question of where you got your influence for your deep spirituality. I know it's taken a journey, maybe from your childhood to now, but I'd love to hear how that was planted in you so deeply.
There are so many people that I would like to say thank you that made this life possible. But it was the people who I really got to just watch how they lived their life and hear their story about their life. And that's what led how I got to where I'm at. It was by watching other people around me and listening to their story and understanding that relationship that they had to protect the earth and to accept me and as worthy as holding a space. So I try when I meet people to transmit to them their worthiness and their powerfulness, and I want to empower them to, you know, look at where they are and where they're standing and how beautiful it is and how much is at risk of being lost if they don't stand up. But when I was really, when I was born, it was a very traumatic event. It wasn't just a regular birth. My mother had lost a son, a full-term baby in childbirth. They saved her life, but she had heart disease. So they told her to come back, and they would have this heart surgery for her. Back in those days, they called it open heart surgery, and the only place it was done was in Omaha, Nebraska, in a heart facility there. So she went back. She went home. Her and my dad were deeply affected by the loss of their son. And when it was time for her to go back and get prepared to have this open heart surgery, she was pregnant. And they told her, "You need to abort this child. You will die. You and this child, your heart is so bad, you will both die. There's no way we can guarantee either one of your safeties." It was a miracle that my mom survived that childbirth. And so she went home and she told my dad. And then they decided together that they were going to use prayer and they were going to pray that both of us would survive. And that's what they did. They prayed and they prayed and they prayed. And then when she was having labor, then she went back to the hospital. But they had already known that she was in danger and was a high-risk pregnancy. So when they got there, they called the heart doctors and they called everybody who was on staff that could possibly, you know, save her and save me. And they did. They saved both of us. I was born. She didn't die. But she was so, so weak that she was immediately transferred. They had to make a spot for her in Omaha so that she could have this heart surgery. So in the meantime, my dad took me home to the Badlands in South Dakota, where I got to meet my grandmother. And it was there I started learning about nature. She spoke Lakota to me. I was in a crib way out in the middle of the grass lines overlooking the Badlands in a cabin. So the window was open, and I learned from a very small age about being alone, because it was me, her, and my dad. And my first recollections of life is the smell of spring and rain and coming through that window, because I was born in the wintertime. But I can remember spring coming. I could, those essences and seeing that grass just blow when the wind blew out that window looked to me like water, water waves, but they were gold and they were so, for me, soothing. And my dad worked out in the field. And so they had devised a plan on how to take care of me, and it involved this bell. This bell was hung outside the cabin. And it was tied to a string. And I was inside the cabin in a crib. And so when I needed attention, I would grab the string and I would jerk on the string and pull on it, and the bell would ring. And then at first my grandmother would come in from outside and take care of me. And then she passed that after that first winter with her. So the second winter I was alone in that spring. By then I could stand up and walk. I walk around and stay in my crib. My dad was still working in the fields. So I would ring this bell, and this horse would come.
Mm-hmm.
This horse would come and tend to me. So my first babysitter was literally a horse. And this horse, my mother was like a horse. She would come and she would tend to me best she could. And if she couldn't console me or soothe me, then she'd run the fields looking for my dad. And then when my dad would see this horse coming, he knew that I needed him, and he would jump on this horse, and the horse would bring him back, and he would take care of me. So my first experiences were being, you know, having the wind come in that window, watching all the seasons change from that window, having an animal come soothe me and take care of me, and eventually my mom was released from the hospital, and I was about two maybe when I returned to my family. And it was hard for me because I was the outsider. I wasn't this brand new baby that people wrap their arms around and say, "Oh, beautiful, welcome to the family," on my mom's side, because she had, I had many older siblings and I was the youngest.
Right.
So I was like the neighbor's kid or the cousin or the niece that, you know, just was brought home one day and said, here she is, your sister. And everybody looked at me like, really? That's our sister? Thankfully, we moved back to the reservation. I met my mom's, her elders, and they had pity on me. They could see that I was the youngest and that I was alone. And they told me stories. They told me stories of when they were on horseback, how they crossed rivers, where they would set up a camp, stories of what happened along the way as they were moving camp. Because these people were born in the 1800s, and they were old, and they were elderly, and they wanted to share these stories. So they told all the stories. A lot of them included animals, how they treated animals, how people got their names from animals, the relationship, with the winds. The winds have names. The plants have names. They have purposes. They have duty. The plant nation is a healing nation. We need to protect the land so our environments become healthy, because that's how you cure a community, is by keeping the land healthy and honoring the plants and using them as medicine and being one with nature. That's what I was taught when I was little, and that's what we need to return to now. That's why I want to protect water. That's my life calling, because I understand life. I mean, water sustains all life, starting with the plant nation, then moving on to all the animals, and then, humans. We can't live without water. Nothing can. So that's where my basis for loving the world and the protecting the water and seeing our relatives as, these animals are our relatives. We need to live in harmony with them and protect their habitat too. We can't just erase them or let them die because we need that land. And the same goes with the plants. All these plants, that these herbicides people are putting down, they're killing the medicine that grows in the area where it's needed. Creator provided all of this for us, all of it. If there's an illness in the community, then Creator has set up a system where the plants that grow in that neighborhood will filter out will try its hardest to wash it out with rains and then to filter it out with plants and then to grow these plants that will heal people. That's how powerful our mother is, the mother that we live on, the mother we call Earth. It's set up so beautifully that we're provided for if we just live with nature and remember that we're just one nation on this globe of several hundred thousand different species, and we're just one.
So was this deep connection with the animals and with water what inspired you to fight against two pipelines, to leave your life and devote all of your being to this?
Those teachings that were instilled in with me, I carried them all over with me, and I met other people growing up in school, teachers, other outside people from the communities that would come in, and they would have workshops. And so I went to school on a reservation. I graduated from a tribal college in South Dakota, Sinte Gleska University. I got a degree there. And then I got married. I left the reservation, and I met other tribal people in other places. I've met powerful indigenous women speakers who talked about the sacredness of life, that children were sacred. And that's the one thing I had that kept me alive as long as I am, and kept me, kept me in ceremony and in a sacred spot, because I didn't have aunties. My mom did pass away before she got to see my children. So that was always a really big heartache for me, because I didn't have grandparents, because my mom's sisters had all passed away. My mom's sisters had all passed away, so none of my aunties, they didn't have grandmas. It was a really hard time for Native women. And when I looked around me, everybody had aunties, uncles, cousins, grandpas, grandmas. And because, my mom's family had lost all the women, two generations of women, then I didn't have aunties and I didn't have grandmas. So all these other people came in. When I heard a woman talking about the power of women, the power of life, I listened intently to their message because I could feel it. I could feel it, but I didn't have anyone to demonstrate it right in front of me except for me. And I had these children that depended solely on me for everything. Mm-hmm. And that's how our world is. Our world depends upon us to protect the world. And if we protect the world will protect us. So my children, they kept me sober because I was scared of what would happen if I went out with all my friends and was drinking and I left them with somebody who they might be drinking to. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But this fear for their safety and of them being too far from me, that's what kept me sane. That's what kept me sober, is that this love I had for my kids, that if they were somewhere else, I was in fear for their safety, because that's the kind of climate we live in. There's abuses in homes all over the planet. Mm-hmm. Children are being neglected. They're not being fed. Parents have to leave them, sometimes with strangers, in order to work, to make money for that family. To go, maybe they have to, maybe one of them's in the hospital and they have to spend a lot of time at the hospital. They have to leave their children with somebody, and they have to trust whoever is closest to them that they can rely on to take good care of their children in the best way they can. And sometimes it turns out terrible. But it was this fear that something would happen to my children that kept my kids close to me. And having them so close to me and not having anyone else to support me kept me on top of my skills, on top of my game, so I could protect them and make sure that they had food, they had water, they had clothing. So we were a very tight-knit circle, and I kept my kids in my home. I was scared to let them go anywhere else. Because there's this thing that happened. The Oglala Aquifer was underneath our reservation in most of Nebraska and I think three states. But when that pipeline was going to be built, it was going to be close to the aquifer and on our tribal land that was over the aquifer. And so we made a stand. We put up a camp right there, right where the pipeline was going to go through, and we're going to say, not on our land, not on our aquifer, because we understand the sacredness of life. At that time, our tribe was sending out messages and letting everybody know, because we do have annual ceremonies every summer to celebrate life, how sacred water is and that it can't be contaminated. And this pipeline was a threat to that Oglala Aquifer, and not just for us, but for all the people in Nebraska, for the farmers, for the animals. And so when the camp was set up, I learned everything about water protection and how to fight a pipeline at a tribal camp. It was called the Rosebud Tribe Spiritual Camp. But I lived out there. I moved out there because I felt the calling, and my son went out there. He felt the calling. And I had a grandson out there. My first grandson was born, and I wanted water for him to be able to play in the creeks and the streams that I played in. I wanted the water to be clean for him, and it was in danger. So that's why I ended up out there. That's why my son ended up out there. And then I had this revelation. I saw this thing happen right in front of my eyes, and it was like I don't even know how to explain it. But so we went shopping. We had been absent from home, from our homes, and so we went shopping, and we had left our family, like his girlfriend, and was at home alone in the beginning watching the baby. And we were at the camp, so she came. We spent all our money. We got everything she needed for another month. And we were visiting, and we had a really good time. We got done shopping. We were walking out to the car. And I just saw, when I was going through the doors, pushing the car, I saw this image of my grandson, you know, hanging by his arm from the trunk of the car. And I blinked my eyes, and my heart jumped, and I started running. And then I looked right in front of me, and there's the car, and there's my grandson, and he's not hanging from, you know, by his arm. And I'm thinking, what was that? But still, this fear was in me, and my momentum was already moving, so I was moving closer to the car. And then as soon as I got halfway between the store and the car, the cart slipped. My grandson stuck his arm out to grab something, and he grabbed the car, and my daughter-in-law slammed the trunk, so he was hanging there. So I had seen it just seconds before that, and I was already moving to the car, so I ran over there, grabbed him. She popped open the trunk. The only thing we had in the car, and he was screaming. I looked at his hand, and it was swollen. The fingers were bent the wrong direction, and I was thinking, oh my goodness, he needs to get to a hospital as soon as possible because his hand's broke. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing we had in the back of the car, so they start throwing stuff in the back of the car. The only thing we had that we carried with us was water. That's all I had. So I grabbed the water and I started praying. I poured it on his hand. I said, Creator, please, please don't let my grandson lose his hand, because men cannot work without their hands. They need their hands to take care of the people. Don't, you know, and I just was thinking all these things, and I just start pouring the water in the palm of his hand because that's all I could do. And I just closed my eyes and I prayed and I poured the water and I prayed and poured the water. And then his hand began to look normal. And so I wrapped it up, and I gave him to his mom, and jumped in the car. We were ready to go, and then he started screaming again. So I jumped back out. I put him in my arms. I grabbed the water, and I start praying again. And I poured it until the water was gone, until there was no more water left. And when I was gone, his fingers were straight, and they weren't. They were still puffy and colored, but they looked normal again. So I carefully wrapped them up. And I gave him to his mom. And we had spent all our money, the only thing we had money, and he was screaming his head off. Still, he was in pain. So we drove to McDonald's. We grabbed all of the change out of the car, and we bought him an ice cream cone and a cup of ice water. And I stuck his hand inside that water. And we were driving to the nearest hospital because I thought his fingers were broken. And then about 20 minutes into the drive, of course, the ice cream cone settled him down. And then he wanted to pull his hand out of the cup, and we unwrapped that little cloth. And then he was just a little tiny guy. He wasn't even 2 years old. But then he showed his hand to me, and there was his hand, and his fingers weren't bent, and the swelling was gone, and they weren't scraped and bruised anymore. And when I saw that, I was so thankful. I made a pledge right then and there. I started crying. I said, Creator, thank you. Thank you. And I said that I would protect water to the end of my days, even if it took my life, because I had been shown that water can heal. That water can heal. And so I know the power of water because I've seen it with my own two eyes. It heals. Right. So water is magical. It can do what we need it to do, but we have to protect it. We can't let it be contaminated. We can't let pipelines, you know, threaten our water supply, because we need to drink that. The plant nation needs that. The animal nation needs that. So it was, for me, it's a common sense statement. But our spirits need to rise up. Our spirits need to rise up and protect that water. Because if it's not, if our spirits don't do it, then it's not going to be protected. It needs to be a spiritual movement. We need to get on that front line and not be afraid to stand there until we can ensure that our water is protected for life. So I do this for life, basically.
I remember at Standing Rock, I met both of your children there, Happy and Elias. And I remember hearing the story of when Happy was one of the first ones to lock himself to the machine at Standing Rock. And can you share more about that and what you are going through as a mother, not just the water protector?
Happy came to the Rosewood Spiritual Camp in the spring, the spring of the second year. And at that time it was cold. Our resources were being drained and people were tired, and they were going to temporarily close the camp for a couple of months until, you know, spring was done, and we were going to have our annual celebration in a couple of months, and then we were going to open it back up again. But people were tired and the resources were being drained, and when I went to the people talking that said that they were going to close the camp, my heart jumped. And I said, oh my goodness, we cannot close this camp we just cannot close this camp. So I just made a pledge. I said, you know what, I'll go out there, because it's in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the cornfield, in the middle of, like, nowhere. The KXL, the Rosewood Spiritual Camp. So I made a pledge. I said, you know what, I will go out there. We don't have to use any resources, you know, other than, you know, keep the electricity on and the water out there. And I'll take care of the camp. I'll go out there because people are still coming. Mind you, we had people from, you know, nearly 100 different countries coming to that camp. Less than 100, but I can't remember the number anymore. But it was a pretty big number from different countries. People have come to pledge their support for the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people were still coming. And so I didn't want the camp to close down because I wanted to let them know that no, it doesn't matter what. We will be there to receive you. We will be there to give you the information you need to stand up and protect your water. And so I did. And I had Happy go out there with me because I couldn't be out there alone. He said, well, Mom, I don't know about that. And I said, just come, please. I had to beg him. But he came. That was his first experience at the camp. It was a solitary one. He was out there. He'd be out there, then I'd be in town, then I'd be up out, then he'd be in town. But there was somebody always at camp. And then, more sure enough, you know, more people came and then didn't have to be out there by themselves. And the camp was, more people came, the local people came back. And so everything was good, and that was his experience until the Dakota Access Pipeline started up. And then I asked him again. I said, son, I said, can you come with me? We need you at this camp. And he said, is it going to be like Keystone? I said, it's going to be a little different because there's going to be a lot more people for one thing, but it's the same thing. We're going to be living in teepees and we're going to be praying out there and we're going to be protecting the water and we're going to be disseminating information. So he said, okay, I'll go do it. And then a transformation happened within him. Before we went to the camp, he went to the training on how to take care of horses, horse handling training. Very, very important that he connect. I tell the story that how he connected with these horses. So a week of training, then at the end of the week, I think they went on a 10-mile trail ride. So he had learned what he needed to how to safely handle a horse. The very next week, we met. On that Friday, he was done. We met again, and then we went to another horse camp with the Nakota horses, and they taught him how to handle a horse, a wild horse, in 3 days. You can, with love and with spiritual intent, these horses will communicate with you and they'll understand what it is you're asking of them as long as you treat them honorably and honestly, because they can read your intent. That's how smart these horses are. So he was there for a week. They tell you how horses are so you can change your behavior, because horses don't have to change. Humans have to change how they treat horses. So that was what the training was for. So we both went. And then from there, we went to another gathering. We went to a spiritual Sundance gathering. And then from there, we went to another ceremony. So for 4 weeks, we were preparing to get to Standing Rock. I mean, we drove up there in between these places, these events, but still we were in training. And when we got there, I left him there. I said, okay. And I had to work for a month. So on weekends, I'd go, and he was there a month manning the teepee that we had set up for the Rosebud people. And the camp was growing. The children were running. And it was on their run to D.C. that he had to stay and man the camp because most everybody from camp was leaving. So he did.
Mm-hmm.
He did. And in that time, we called people to help us, so other campers are showing up. He met people from the Oglala Nation, and that's where his dad is from. That's where my dad is from. And he learned about direct action. He learned about, ceremony. And then when I was up at Peshla taking care of these horses, because that's why we were in training to get these, because horses were coming to us. And so they came to Peshla. We had ceremony with them, and one of the promises that I have to keep in having these horses is every 4 days I have ceremony. I have a 4-day ceremony with them every single month, and I take new people to them. So I was up doing that. He was at the camp. And then I got a text message early in the morning, and someone said to me, if that was my son, I would be crying. And I was thinking, what are they talking about? Was someone from camp? So I drove up on the hill at Peshla where I could get signal and be with the horses. And then I just got tons of images. People start sending me things, and there was a live feed going on out there, and then videos. And there was my son locked onto one of those excavation equipments, and they were singing songs for him. And he was singing Mini Wichoni, Water is Life. And I was so scared I would cry, and then I would pray for his safety, and then I would calm down. And then somebody would send another video. Another video would pop up. They don't know how to extract him. The people are going to hurt him. You know, he's mm-hmm. going to lose an arm. And all these people and these images were just all over Facebook. And mm-hmm. so I spent maybe 5 hours up on that hill. I would be scared. And then I would pray. And then I would say, create. And then Creator would let me know everything's going to be okay. And then a lawyer called me. And then, you know, people from the camp start calling me directly. And they started giving me updates. And but I went, it was so emotional for me. I just cried my heart out because I thought, you know, they were going to rip off his arms. And then mm-hmm. They were going to saw them off. And then, but Creator, every time I asked him for help, he would calm me down. I would mm-hmm. let all of that fear go away in prayer. And then I would be calm again. And so at one point I was so excited and I was so worried. I started the car and I was going to leave. I was 5 hours away from camp. I was going to leave. So I put the car in drive, stepped on the gas. Bam, I heard this really huge, huge, loud noise, and I thought it was my radiator. But it wasn't. I had a major blowout. I had a blowout in my front tire. I ran over a rock. And so from that point on, I was stuck there. So mm-hmm. I sat there that for hours listening, going back and forth. And what he had done, I was so afraid of his life because I knew that the people weren't going to treat him right, the law enforcement. But they did their best. I mean, mm-hmm. they did their jobs. They did what they were asked to do. The people came and supported him. And from that moment on, and that was on August 31st, because of the live streams and because of the Facebook videos, that action woke up all of the activists who were protecting mm-hmm. water for decades. Because they're, you know, the Clean Water Act, that came from activists. So these activists were waiting. They weren't waiting. They were all busy protecting water in their own little groups. But when that video went out, they coalesced. They all decided, we're going to Standing Rock and we're going to help them protect the water because they're calling us. So on that day, a message was sent all over Facebook and all the water activists showed up. Mm-hmm. They started coming in droves. So that was the beginning of the message that was sent out to the world, that we're serious. We will do whatever we need to do. If we have to put our lives on the line, we will do that. And when he was on the line, I was so afraid for his life that I just cried and I just prayed and prayed and cried. And by the time, eventually I got off the hill, a guy came up and out of nowhere, get this, after it was all over and he was jailed and they were having a candlelight vigil outside the jail chanting, release Happy. They did release him. So after it was all over, I was going to leave the mountaintop because I was at Peshla, a very sacred place where we have ceremony for tens of thousands of years. I was going to leave that place and I started the car and I start driving. And then what happened? Then I remembered I had a flat and the sun was going down. And I was 2 to 3 miles away from, the next, the place where I was staying at. So I was thinking, I was trying to plan out a route of where I was going to walk to get back. And I was thinking, well, the car will probably be safe up here. But anyway, and then after he was taken down and he was safe, I prayed to Creator. And I said, Creator, I said, you have given me so much and you have answered my prayers. I'm not going to ask for anything else today, not anything else. And then I finished my prayer, started my car, and then bam, I remembered I had the flat, couldn't go anywhere. So I didn't even want to pray for help because I didn't even want to ask again because I had given my word. I wasn't going to ask for any more help, and I was going to be happy with that day, the way it ended. And so I sat there, and I was trying to devise this plan because once I left that spot, I wouldn't have phone service. And then I could hear a car coming, and I looked around, and sure enough, off of the next hill over, there was a vehicle coming down the hill. But the road it was on turned left and would go farther away from me. So I was thinking, I wonder if I should jump out and holler and wave or whatever. And I said, no, I'll just wait to see what happens. And it ended up that truck pulled up right behind me, and it was a water protector from the Keystone KXL camp. One of the main protectors showed up out of nowhere and he pulled up beside me and he says, Cheryl, what are you doing out here? And I wanted to say you've answered my prayer, but I didn't say that because I had, you know, taken that vow that day that I wasn't going to ask for anything else. And then so he said it instead. So he said, gee, he said, looks like I'm here to answer your prayer. And he was totally right. He had answered and subconscious prayer. I knew I needed help, but I wasn't going to ask Creator and I wasn't going to pray for help because I had just told him, thank you for everything. I'm not going to ask for nothing else. So it wasn't my prayer. It was my need, certainly, but it was the prayers of all the people who have ever prayed for those who need help and who feel like there isn't a way to turn. It's all those prayers because I was out there and I didn't know which way to go and I did need help. And lo and behold, a pickup pulls up and a water protector jumps out and says, sure, I'll change your tire, no problem. So Cheryl, that's why I have such a deep faith.
Speaking of prayer, like I want to know what guides you and what is this constant thread of prayer that guides you and this light inside of you that brings you to lead 800 people in a march or does something small like, you know, help someone build something. You know, I just feel like every single thing you do, regardless of what it is, it has the same faith feeling, this very prayerful feeling. I'd love to hear more about what guides you and what is this fire inside of you.
Oh, I think it was because I didn't have that, you know, that big support system of mom and dad and uncle and auntie and grandpa and grandma. But when I was really little, I was told, don't forget, you're from Two Kettle. Don't forget when you're out, because we were little kids and we would go down into the creeks. Before we left, that's what they would say. Don't forget you're from Two Kettle. Don't forget that when you're with each other, you have to take care of each other. And if one of you is in trouble, all of you have to help that person. If one of you wants to do something wrong, all of you have to stop them from doing that wrong thing. If one of you is doing something that might put all of you in danger, then all of you have to stop that from happening because you have to depend upon yourself and to take care of each other when you're in this group. And so that's what we did. We learned how to take care of each other. We learned how to stop each other from acting in a wrong way, and we learned how to keep each other out of harm. And if we were in harm, we learned how to protect each other because we were little kids out in the wilderness, the wild wilderness, on our own, and we were allowed to do that, to travel as a group and explore wherever we wanted. So that's what we did every day. But every day we had the same speech. Remember, you're from Two Kettle. Remember, you have to protect each other. Remember to, you know, not let nobody do anything wrong and don't let anybody harm anybody else. So those are our basic rules. Every day we're reminded. And then there's the other talk. The other talk was this. If you ever think you're alone, you're not. You're never, ever alone. Creator's always there. There's animals there. There's land there. There's water there. There's plant nation. You're never, ever alone. So ask for what it is that you need because you're never, ever alone. And so I grew up and I didn't have all this. They passed away. I ended up growing up alone. But I remembered what they said. Creator would always be there to help me. And so I learned how to pray even in the most difficult, painful, life-threatening moments of my life, because my life, I have been kidnapped. People have tried to kill me on more than one occasion. It was people who said that they loved me, and that was the part that literally just broke my heart. But I would always pray in those times of danger and in those times when I was being assaulted and I was being beaten. I would always remember my mom, and then I would think, you know, if today's the day I'm going to die, then I'm going to go with my mom in a peaceful way. I'm not going to be screaming and crying and begging for my life. I'm going to stand there in prayer because Creator is with me, will always be with me. And so that time of my life eventually passed. I wasn't in danger anymore, and I found safety. But it was in prayer, and I would always pray, Creator, please, take me someplace good where I can serve, where I can do something good. No matter how hard my life was, that was my prayer. Creator, please take me someplace good, you know, where I can do something good. because that's basically that's all we were. I mean, as humans, that's what we're meant to be for one another. We're meant to create safe spaces for one another and protect those safe spaces. And we're meant to serve one another in the best mm-hmm. way that we can to protect them. So that was my prayer, and that's been my daily prayer for decades. And whenever I'm in doubt, whenever I'm in fearful, I just, and especially every morning, I pray, Creator, take me someplace good. You know, let me do something good today to help the people.
Can you, what I found so inspiring is when you talked about the Nahi, the seventh direction, and your relationship and all of our relationships with the Nahi. Can you explain that more?
Yeah, the first time I shared the story about the people having a Nahi, because that is the seventh direction. We pray to the four directions, and then we pray to the Creator who's above, our Father, and then the land, our Mother, below. That's the sixth direction. It's a west, north, east, south, and then it's the Creator above, and then it's the Mother below us. And then we pray to the seventh direction, which is our internal spirit that's connected to Creator. That's our Nahi. When we allow our Nahi to lead us, because it's connected to Creator, there isn't any place bad it will take us. But that was my prayer, because I wanted, when I say, Creator, take me someplace good, I'm directing my internal spirit, my Nahi, to follow whichever way Creator tells me to go. And our Nahi speaks to us. We just don't listen to it. And it's, men call it a gut feeling. I have this gut feeling. Well, that's their Nahi trying to tell them what it is not to do or to do. But so people have to listen to their gut feeling. And for women, they call it intuition. Well, men have intuition too, but they explain it as a gut feeling. So our intuition is actually our Nahi hinting to us, sending us bodily responses, because we carry it with us, of how to act. And so this Nahi is the power that we have that we need to grow so our spirit can lead us easier, because we're on a human path. We believe freedom is having the choice of a job, getting a job, living in which community, doing the work that we do, and maybe driving a car and owning a home. We all think that's freedom, but the real freedom is a spiritual freedom that can let all of that go and do good things, do really good things that are spirit-led. That they can still involve all those things, but the spirit has to take them to that spot, and they have to connect with that spirit and talk to that spirit and recognize it, because we want it to grow, and that's what, as Lakota, we have all these ceremonies for, is because they're for our Nahi. They're to keep us healthy, to keep us on the right path. So we always talk about the red road and the black road, and we need to be on the red road, not the black road, because that's full of pain and suffering and personal choices and wants.
You know what really moved me at Standing Rock is that it was very matriarchal, which is something I hadn't experienced before. And I learned so much about the importance of being a woman to Mother Earth and to society. And I just would love to hear about what women mean to Mother Earth in your culture, and feminine as a powerful Indigenous leader. How do you see women leading today?
Women have been leading for a very long time, because, first of all, we're creators of life. Just like Mother Earth is a creator of life and a nurturer of life, and water is a sustainer of life, women, we bring life to this world. And as such, we are water carriers. We carry life in water, just like the earth does. The earth sustains this whole planet with water. So we're an extension of that. We embody symbolically and physically an earth. So we stand upon the earth as water protectors because that's our job. We're water carriers and we're water protectors because we protect life. So that's as simply as I can say that. But there are ceremonies. There's water ceremonies that we conducted over and over at Standing Rock and are conducting everywhere on the globe every time we pray with water. Because water heals. Water is the essential connector of all life. But yeah, that's basically what it is. We're water carriers, and it's our duty to protect that life for all women. And there's a way of instruction and leadership in our tribes, and it has to do with our creation story. It's really, I'll tell you how about how man was created and the roles of the men and the women. So in the beginning, there was just one creator, just one immense, one thing, one energy, creator. But eventually, creator wanted someone else to share that power. So because he's the only thing, he has to create from himself because there's only one thing. So he opened himself up. But once he did that, there was no stopping the flow from him. At the end of all of this flow, of all of his energies, he was hard and he was brittle. But he was surrounded by all of the power that was within him. It was now without him. So he was his hard, brittle essence and the creator. All of his powers was around it. And so, and he looked at this hard, brittle thing and he had pity on it of what he had created because it was so hard and brittle. And then it spoke, and it said, "Oh my goodness, I'm freezing to death here. I'm a rock." And so immediately he responded. He responded and created the sun. And then pretty soon she was baking on one side, and she was hot on freezing on the other. And he created the moon, so there was rotation involved, you know, and all the stars. And then she was still dry and brittle. And then he created the rain, but the whole way I'm telling this story is really simple, and this is how we rule our family lives and our society is the way the story is told. There was only one thing in the beginning, and from that one thing then there became two things, a female and a masculine essence. Mm-hmm. And so when the female said, "I'm hard as a rock, I'm cold and brittle," he responded and created the sun. So that's how we run our families. Anytime the women are in charge of saying what's needed, and the men are in charge of protecting and providing for that woman. And we base that on the creation of life. That's how life was created. So that's how we should conduct our life too. So if you go back to the videos and you look at any of the videos at Standing Rock, when there was a powerful action happening, you can hear the women. I'm going to go back to the day when there was a man who wanted to who had been infiltrating the camps and who had brought a rifle and he was trying to get into the camp. So when the raid came, they could say the camp had a weapon. That was the intent. But what had happened is he was driving on the road to get to camp, and he was identified as an outsider who had a weapon. And so he drove through people got on the road and tried to stop him, and he just plowed through them, and they got out of the way safely. But then we had radio, so we were waiting. He's coming down the road. He's got a rifle. He just ran everybody off the road. So they put the cars up on the road, and then he tried to swerve off the cars and go down into the ditch. Another vehicle, a security vehicle, chased him down and then rammed his car in off the road, so he had to get out. And when he grabbed his gun and he ran. And in the video that you can see him running. He had the rifle, and the women were saying, "Don't let him go. Surround him. Stop him." And even we were there standing, so the men that heard her call that were there, they ran after him with no weapons, with open hands, and surrounded him. And he was in the river. He had made it to the river. And one of them approached him with no weapons or anything and had his hands up and told him to not harm people and to let go of that gun. And eventually he he was disarmed and he was mm-hmm. taken into custody. But the whole power of that incident was a woman was saying, "Don't let him leave, surround him." And the men responded. And that's mm-hmm. just one story. There were many stories of direct actions when women stood up and said, "Stop or stand or wait or move or help." I personally, the most inspiring thing I ever saw happen at Standing Rock happened the night when we were being water cannoned. And I was in mm-hmm. ceremony and I was on the front line and I was getting, you know, but I wasn't in front of the tank. I don't want to stand up against a machine. I would rather go down face to face to where they were standing with their weapons. So mm-hmm. I went to the front line and I could see them face to face right on the other side of that cantina wire. And I was having ceremony and I was singing. I was talking to them and I told them that we would find them new jobs and to have faith in us and that they were our family and that I wanted them to join us and be water protectors because we needed them. So while I was on the front line singing to the police. So while they were shooting at us, I was out there praying and delivering this message and we were standing in peace. And the people
in below freezing temperature too, I'd like to add.
Oh yeah, it was like a war zone. But yeah. That's where prayer is needed. It's needed to get on the front line to remind those people who have the weapons that we're their family and they're shooting their family and that there mm-hmm. is an alternative way. So that's why I'm always on the front line because that's where the prayer is needed. That's where the ceremony is needed. That's where I find myself. But anyway, on this night, they had soaked everybody and everybody was freezing to death and there was the cars coming down the hill to that spot were picking up people who were soaked and freezing. And then the cars were coming in and cars were going out. Medics were coming. There were medics all over taking care of the people. But the story I want to talk about is, so they were going to put out, they had started this fire because people were soaking wet. And the fire was to warm the people. And so I walked over to the fire because by that time I had been knocked down by the water cannon. My shoes were all full of water. And although I had a wool coat on, which protected me, my feet were freezing. Mm-hmm. So I walked over there, and some guy said, "Hi, Unchi." And he said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Can you take off my shoes? They're full of water." And I had those, you know, those boat shoes. Anyway, they were pouring the water out of one shoe when the water cannon hit us. They were trying to put out mm-hmm. the fire. And so all the men stood up like a shield. And I'm not kidding, for merely a minute, they were just being blasted with that water until they couldn't stand up anymore. And they all took off, and the water hit the flames, and steam came up. And there was me and this one guy that was still standing from Sacred Stone, and this shiny thing blew by in front of me. So I reached over, and I grabbed it. And I said, "Will this protect the fire?" And he said, "Only if we kneel down and hold it up like a shield." So we knelt down in front of that fire, just me and him, and we covered up the side that was being, that the water was being aimed at. And they were trying to knock us down. They had the water right on our backs, but we still knelt there in front of the fire, and we held up the shield over the water mm-hmm. until the water, and it was literally pushing us with those closer to the fire, and the fire was hissing, and all the steam was coming out. And then we couldn't see anything, and then we couldn't breathe anymore. So we both got up, and there was this big, they stopped water canning the fire. They thought they put it out because it was all steam. We couldn't see anything, but I could hear a woman saying, "Gather dry wood. We need dry wood. Gather more dry wood." I could hear her saying that. Mm-hmm. And when the steam went away and I was standing at the front line again and next to the wire where the water cannon was. So I turned around and I went back towards the opposite direction because by then I was so heavy with water. I must have gained 20 pounds, and I could barely walk. I was just totally drenched from top to the bottom, and I started making my way back to the fire, and what I saw was unbelievable. When the steam moved away, she was saying, I could hear her, she was saying, grab the logs, and so men ran over to the fire, pulled the logs out of the fire, and they were embers. They were glowing embers at the tips of these fires. And already there was a new pile of wood where she had told people to put the wood, and they went running with these logs. They're small logs that they were running with. And when the wind hit them, they were like matchsticks. It's like boom, boom, boom. I I saw fire, just like matchsticks, at the end of these logs. They were these. Mm-hmm. They were running with these logs that were on fire, and they stuck them into the dry wood that she was had been calling for, and within a matter of 3 minutes, there was another huge fire blazing mm-hmm. from, and it was a woman who led that action.
Wow.
And so people went to that fire, and of course, they had put it just right out of the range of where the water cannon could come put that fire out. So that was amazing. That was the most miraculous thing I had ever seen. And it was from the woman's voice. So as women, our power is recognizing the needs of the family and of the community. And we need to remember that and honor our men, because those are the ones who respond and those are the ones who provide and protect.
Wow. Cheryl, thank you so much for sharing that story, the power of women and community. And speaking of mm-hmm. community, we're actually at the top of the hour, so I would like to just let our callers know or remind them that you can press *6 to add a question to the queue. You can also email the question at ask@thisspace.org, and one of us will ask that. I know that things that Pancho was interested in asking about, the connection between nonviolence and Gandhi and the Nagi, and your tradition of really kind of standing up from a similar space. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a really deep question and a very, very important I think people have to reform. They have to understand the power that they wield. And they are not going to be able to do that until they recognize their Nahi. And that's their spirit. So once they recognize, and the spirit's created, it's part of Creator. There's millions of Nahis out there. And so they can actually unite. It's hard to describe. But for example, when we had our silent march, our women-led silent march on the bridge, I talked about creating this space and holding this space, that the women need to have this space where our spirits could sit in peace and meditate for peace and protection. But in order for us to hold that space, that spiritual space, we needed the men to be called upon to protect us. And they have to have their Nahis in the right space too. So it's like, for most people, it's like meditating. You can meditate into that place where you understand where you're going to stand. No one's going to move you. So this satyagraha, this force is already within us. We just don't recognize or empower it. And this spiritual force, that's what creates change in human beings. When we recognize just how powerful we are and how more powerful we can be when we unite as one, it's amazing, because we held that bridge, and that space on that bridge, in silent prayer with women all kneeling down. And the opposition was, I'm thinking, overwhelmed and shocked, because the majority of them were all non-native, and they were all in prayer, and we were having ceremony. And I told them right to their face, we're having ceremony, and because of proximity, you're in my ceremony, and the ceremony is you. And so you could see the people wanting, in the military uniforms, you could see them wanting to back off that front line because they didn't want to be in ceremony with us. But they were anyway, because they couldn't get off that front line. So it was that people call it a love force, and I guess that's a good way to put it, because it's the love for peace, the love for safety of your fellow man, and the commonalities to share whatever knowledge we have between the common man, you know. So I hope that helps understand. But yeah, so we all have a Nahi, and that's where our most powerful feelings come from and our most spiritual empowerment comes from our Nachi.
Sure. Pancho is back in queue, so let's see if we can have him hear him this time. Pancho, are you there?
Now can you hear me, all beautiful people?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. I wish you could all see our smiling faces here. It's been great to listen and how Colleen and you, Cheryl, have been connecting to the depth of this movement. And there's so much stuff I would like to ask, but the first thing is that that I love you very much, and that we're using these means in a way to planetize a movement. And I want to ask something around that that you're saying right now, Cheryl, and how you have this vision and this intuition that this is beyond the Standing Rock, and that one of the powerful things that you were feeling when we were there in on camps and connecting with people, that you felt that millions and millions of people were with you and were with us, and that you were imagining this indigenous uprising and guidance. So there's something along the lines of the roots where we're coming from. But then you take it to the next level and you say that we all are indigenous to this planet. We're all indigenous to Mother Earth. And then you came to the Bay Area, and then you spoke with students from UC Berkeley where they were there, the Gill tribe, were talking to some land protectors, and most of them, they're white folks, and they were moved to tears when you were connecting to them and telling them that they were land protectors, that was their responsibility now. They were born here, and even though most of the indigenous folks have been decimated for this cultural and physical genocide, but they're here now, and their responsibility is to take care of the land, and they took it, and they love it. And then you went to Stanford, to a private university, and did the same, and the kids and the youth connected again. And not only that, then you went to the part of the planet we call Mexico, and I think that's where I want to stop, that you were there connecting with these indigenous folks that have been in a community of cooperatives for 40 years, and they got inspired by the water protectors in Standing Rock, by Happian, by all the people that were putting their lives on the line, and they decided to make a camp, a natural building house, blocking the power lines that have the intention to create a hydroelectric, but without the power lines, they can do anything. And today is the day that house, with an orchard and with corn and with squash and with beans, and the three sisters are holding strong there, blocking that power line inspired by Standing Rock. And you were in that place, and people were grateful for what you were doing. So I just want to say, if you were able right now, because you do it with your prayers and with your nonviolent evil, but if you were able to tell a message to the water protectors of the world and the land protectors of the earth right now, and you have the means, because this is a planetary call, what would you tell them? What will you tell us?
I would tell them... it's a really simple speech, and they're halfway to where they need to be, and I'm halfway to where I need to be too. But this is it. Whenever activists who have been, you know, actively protecting the land and tribal territories and their own communities across the globe, we have activists. When they become spiritual, they move from just being an activist to a spiritual activist. And when people who lead in prayer, I'm going to call them spiritualists, because there are so many interdenominational faiths on this planet, which is a beauty in its own. But whenever they use their prayer and their spiritualism, when they move that into becoming an activist who will stand, you know, in a nonviolent manner. They're the we have everything. We have the activists who have learned how to become spiritual because they're watching spiritual become active. And spiritual people will learn how to become activists because they're watching activists. So those are the two things that we need, those two groups, because that's what I saw as the dividing line in Standing Rock. We have all the activists. They've been actively protecting in all kinds of ways, any ways that they could think of except spiritually. And then we have all the spiritualists who are protecting the planet with prayers for tens of thousands of years with their prayers, but they haven't been active. So when you get them both together to stand together, then you have all of the power that you need to stop anything. And that's what's happening. Spiritualists are becoming active. Activists have become spiritualists. And that group of people are leading in nonviolent direct action, standing up in prayer to stop the destruction of our planet, because that's what's happening. They're destroying our water. Our water's in danger. And they're taking away land that tribal people have used to maintain their sovereignty, to feed themselves, to clothe themselves, to shelter themselves. That's the most powerful movement. It's the most natural movement on the planet. Naturally, people want to protect their family with love. Naturally, they want to preserve the land that they've lived off of and protect it, because that's where the medicine grows. A healthy environment means a healthy community. And across the globe, we have so many illnesses, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and it's because we're not living in a natural state in our environment. Our environment's being plowed up. So many bad things are happening to the earth. My message is that to have faith, continue standing in a nonviolent manner, put the call out that we need, send messengers out, because that's what we used to do a long time ago. We'd send them a message and they'd start running. So standing right now, all the messengers have been deployed. They're all running to different parts of the globe and the country, and they're saying, stand up. Stand up wherever you're standing, because the land that you are standing on, that was our a tribe lived there, and they lived in harmony with nature. You know, honor that tribe. Recognize, find out who that tribe is. Go to them and say, you know, we're here. We'll stand with you to protect this land and protect this water, because now we're the new occupants. That's a responsibility. That's the message that needs to go out there. Wherever you're standing, protect that water, protect that land. It doesn't matter what faith you are, what color you are. If you have feet on the ground and you drink water, then you protect that land, you protect that water. And so in Mexico, right now, there's a woman, Maria de Jesus.
Yeah, Marichuy, that's right.
Yes, Marichuy. She has stood up to protect her land and her people, all Mexican people.
And there are 71. Some of the people that started Sol March with Gandhi, there were 78. Well, this is 71 indigenous people that are doing and supporting Marichuy. So it's beautiful. I'm so happy that you're bringing this up, this revolutionary love, to this angle now.
Yeah.
Sorry,
women have women have always been the sustainers and the nurturers of life, and men have always stood up to protect the women and the children and work to provide for them. That's the most natural relationship that you can have. So it's natural for a woman to stand up and tell the country, stop digging up, stop excavating, stop, you know, harming the water, quit polluting the land, let our schools continue to teach in the most natural way that they can. Let us be people. And that's for everybody, for life. She understands what life is, and she wants a good life for all the people that stand wherever they're standing, especially in Mexico. So I support her 100%. We need someone like her running for president in the United States and in all these other countries, because that's the lesson. A lesson is being taught at Standing Rock, and that's women-led direct actions will protect the water and will defend the land and the resources that all these, you know, these interested people, these capitalists that want to make money, they're making that off tribal lands, off tribal resources. That land's not their land. They just want to lease it and take, dig up, you know, contaminate the water and dig up the land and then take the resource and sell it and become rich. They don't care about the health and the safety of the community or the people because they have no love for them. But women, we have love for plants, for family, for land, and we have, you know, the love of our family and the love of men to support us. So everywhere in the world, women need to stand up. It's our job, it's our role to say, protect us. We're water carriers. We have to stand and protect the water. So protect us while we protect.
You know? I just wanted to remind you that they can star 6 to get into the queue or also send an email at ask@servicebase.org. And we do have a question that came in online from Albert Rowe, and he says, thank you. Thank you for sharing with us the beautiful energies of compassion. Your voice carries the universal wisdom of love. Albert, up in the Sierra Mountains. So just a little kind note that you wanted to send through. Cheryl, you know, my question that I have for you is, you know, it seems that prayer is actually deeply central to everything that you've done and to your entire journey from the beginning of your life. And I'm curious to understand a little bit more about what prayer really means to you. From what I've understood, it sounds like it's simply around asking the Creator for help. But I'm curious if it's more than that for you.
Yes, it is. In my culture, we have several ceremonies and songs. So a lot of it is songs. If you hear a tribal person singing, they're usually praying for the people. They're having a ceremony. So my life's been about, you know, ceremony, and some of it wasn't good ceremony. But I was always standing in prayer because that's what I was told when I was little. You stand in prayer because you're part of this creation. And the Spirit, I mean, the Creator who created everything, He gave us a piece of Himself. So whenever they say, oh, I created you in the likeness of myself, He's not talking about of our four arms and our two legs. When that statement, and maybe scholars will pick this up and religious people will finally understand what that state really means, but He said He created mankind in the likeness of Himself. He wasn't talking about body, heads, eyes, and arms. He was talking about implanting His Spirit inside of us. So He gave of Himself to create this planet. He gave upon Himself to plant His Spirit within us. That's revolutionary, that Spirit that He gave to us. So basically, when I talk to my Nahi, that's the Nahi I was talking about. He implants a Nahi into every single human being that's born. We all have it. Doesn't matter where we're at, what religion we have. We are connected to Creator. That Nahi can speak to Him, and it can connect to another person's Nahi. And that's why sometimes when we meet someone and we automatically connect and we like each other, we find out we have the same goals, and maybe even some of our children have the same names. We like the same color, the same foods. It's our Nahis are attracted to one another and recognize each other because we're all part of the Creator. We could never be separate. People think we're separate because we live on a continent. People think we're separate because we pray a different way, but we're not. We're all part of Creator, and He gave us each a Nahi. So it's like having a pizza and cutting up that pizza into as many slices as you can get, and everybody gets a piece of that pizza. And it's all the same pizza. So basically, we're all the same. We come from the same Creator. We have the same Spirit. We just recognize it in different forms. And me, I recognize it in my tribal ceremonies. I was lucky. And every tribe has their own ceremonies, too. But it's just that reaching out, Creator. It's like me. It's like plugging back into, if you're a machine, an electrical car. In order for you to work, you have to be plugged in. So we have to plug in. We have to reconnect with the Creator. And the easiest way for me to do it is just to start talking.
Beautiful. We've got a comment that came in online from Victoria Polling in Seattle. She says, "Thank you, Cheryl. I'm so moved to hear you on the call, to hear you call on the women to speak what's needed to protect the land and protect the water. From your perspective, where are the spiritual activists most needed now, this summer?"
You know, every congregation needs a spirit-led movement, a spirit-led movement to protect the land and water. Every congregation, every community, that's where it's happening. Last week, just a few days ago, I was in D.C. at the Union Theological Seminary, and I gave a short speech on the rituals and ceremonies that are needed in water protection, in environmental activism. And we created a ceremony that morning. We had all these, you know, almost 100 different interfaiths there in New York City. And we put flowers in a circle, the petals, and we put food in the center. And we circled around there. I sang. We all prayed for the water. We had a ceremony there, a water ceremony. And later on that week, then everybody came up, and what they had done is in their belief system, they had found passages that supported the love of the earth and the protection of the earth. So every congregation, I don't care if you're in a synagogue or you're a theologian, it doesn't matter where you're at, the ministers need to recognize in their scriptures, it says protect the land and the water, and their scriptures all over. People got up and they shared all the scriptures that they had found. It was, for me, it was unbelievable, because it's always been there. The religious movement has always been instructed to protect the land and the water, but they just haven't done it. So it's happening. It should be happening in your church if it's not. I think you can contact the Union Theology Seminary and ask for their scriptures, and you can pass them right along to your pastor and say, see, you need to be a spiritual activist if you're going to protect the community, because the community needs to be healthy, and it won't be healthy unless the environment is healthy, and the environment won't be healthy unless we stand up to protect it.
I love that. Cheryl, you know, I'm curious, from a purely pragmatic perspective, and we just have a few more minutes here, so maybe this question and one others, but at a purely pragmatic level, a pipeline ended up getting built at Standing Rock. So what was the lesson in all of the prayer and ceremony that happened there?
The lesson in the ceremony is that to continue to pray, to continue to stand, and this is what it is, right? What it comes down to is one man cannot dictate over an entire country. We need an entire country to stand up and show him the wrongs of his thinking. That pipeline is proof that we're insane as a government, because we're going to put in instruments, pipelines, that can literally damage drinking water for millions of people. So that's that capitalism, that plan was just basically was just for money. It has been for money. And the other thing is that the Bakken oil fields, where all of this oil's coming out of, they're nearly dry. They're nearly dry now. That pipeline was never ever needed. It was just needed so somebody could make some money. So we're up against a money institution, and we're consumers. We're capitalists. That's how we were raised, to be consumers, to be capitalists. But we can change that by changing our behavior. Me, I'm on a goal. In 5 years, 50% of all my fossil fuel usage will be gone. Actually, it'll probably be more than that, because I think I'm already at 50% from a year ago. I don't use fossil fuels as much as I do. But that behavior, we have to change our behavior and stop being consumerism and refuse and insist a better product, insist green energy, and refuse to use fossil fuels. Because if nobody buys it, then nobody's going to want to sell it, and there won't be any digging up of this infrastructure. This whole administration in our country has been to build this infrastructure where the people who get rich off fossil fuels will get richer. And we need to stop being a part of that system actively. We need to go into green energy. So that's just that Dakota Access Pipeline is just the images of just how crazy and how off-center and how badly we're going in the wrong direction. So, yeah, that's the lesson. The whole country is being led by one man who's off-center and misleading the whole country.
The final question I'd like to close with is just how we, as the broader service-based community, can support your work.
I think, you know, my work, I feel like my work is really, really small, and I feel like the people are really, really huge, and I need to get out there and continue telling the people, to all the spiritual people, to become activists, because there's millions people praying for Standing Rock. Those millions people that are praying, they need to stand up and become active. They need to be that front line of prayer and do it in a nonviolent way, because that's the power that we need. So if you want to support me, you can go to, because I travel all over the place, wherever people call, wherever they want to stand up in defense of land and water. I made a vow to protect water for my life, so I will do my best to get to where I'm called to talk and to lead and just to stand there. Even if it's doing dishes, I'll do dishes. dishes. Wherever I'm needed at that spot, I'll go. So I do have an account for travel. It's basically really simple. C_ANN_angel@yahoo.com. But I'm going to be honest and tell you that my strength not only comes from Creator, but it comes from this herd of horses that I was given, that was gifted to me, that I pray with. I pray with horses, and I watch these horses, and they heal me, and I have a relationship with these horses that somehow I need to support them. It takes money to support horses, so that's my – people don't know this about me, but I'm dependent on those horses. I love those horses like my new family. They just had 3 new foals, and, you know, they're my new family, so I have to work to support them and provide a safe place for them to live. And that's a whole other story, but it's connected to water. So if someone wants to support my work, they can donate to my PayPal, because, yes, I do – do you need money to survive, just like everybody else? And prayers, please continue praying. Create your own water ceremony in your own front yard, down at your own river that needs healing. Do it in front of a building where the people who the EPA. Do it to the EPA. Anywhere there's water being threatened, go there and have a water ceremony. Invite all the people who pray to come pray with you, to come stand with you, anywhere, because water's everywhere and it's being threatened everywhere. So start your own ritual. Gather your people and pray.
Thank you, Cheryl. And with that, we will end with a closing minute of gratitude or maybe prayer. After which we'll also open up the line. So we'll just take 1 minute of silence or prayer together. Thank you. I am going to unmute everyone on the call, and then we will get the chance to just express our verbal thanks to Cheryl for making me. Right. On the count of three, we will just all say thank you, Cheryl. One, two, three.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.